Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's April 12th, 2019 program, Lunch with Eugene's Mayor, Lucy Venice. This is the 28th program for our 2018-2019 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson. I am the president-elect of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, who exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information can be found at www.kp.org. The University of Oregon, who supports comes to help Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information can be found at uoregon.edu. Peace Health. At Peace Health, their mission is a shared purpose, being founded more than 125 years ago. They exist to promote personal community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, to treat each person in a loving and caring way. For more information, visit peacehealth.org. And our Sapphire sponsor today is Summit Bank. Support for the City Club comes from Summit Bank, your local community bank, an independent community bank headquartered in Eugene, Oregon. Summit Bank serves businesses and professionals in the Eugene, Springfield area, and Central Oregon communities. For more information, visit sbko.bank. Without any further ado, please welcome this week's program coordinator, John Belcher.
Thank you, Eric. It's my great pleasure to welcome Mayor Lucy Venice back to City Club for a conversation. If you haven't been following the City Council lately, let me share what's on their agenda for the next three meetings. Potentially revising the municipal court process, considering the establishment of inclusionary zoning as a way to provide affordable housing, possibly banning panhandling on our streets, and discussing the establishment of an urban reserve district for the Bethel Highway 99 area. And that doesn't include all the things not on the agenda that the city's looking at, such as building a new city hall, developing the e-website, establishing a homeless shelter, and numerous land use issues, including housing strategies and tools, clear and objective standards, providing workforce housing, and LUBA remands on accessory dwelling units, and several bills in the legislature that'll make a significant difference in our land use, and 5G towers, just to name a few. And if that's not enough, there's a public comment period at the beginning of every city council meeting. In the last three council meetings, during the public comment period, 117 people testified for a total of 5.5 hours. So there seems to be an awful lot for Lucy to talk to us about. So I'll get off the dais. She can start the conversation and provide time for your questions. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you, John. That does seem like a daunting list and doesn't include, you know, climate change and economic development and a few other things that are going on, equity issues. So we are definitely busy, but I am very, very happy to be here today. I always appreciate coming to the City Club because you as a body represent community engagement and discussion at its best. People often ask me how I like the job. I like it. I spend my days meeting with people who care about the community and are generous with their time, their insights, and their experience on behalf of the public good. My understanding of community issues grows daily thanks to the hundreds of calls and emails received by council and staff each week. What we hear from you, the citizens, shapes the city's priorities. In 2018 and in 2019, three issues rose to the surface of community concern: homelessness, housing, and community safety. In 2018, the council and city staff laid the foundation for community investment in those three key areas. They are inextricably linked. Decisions about housing impact homelessness. Homelessness impacts perceived and real community safety concerns. Public investment is required for all three, in staffing, operations, outreach, and in some cases, capital. And our community is not of one mind about any of this. I will start with homelessness. We hear from both sides of this very difficult issue, from those who claim the city is enabling a lifestyle that negatively impacts our city aesthetically, economically, and in a loss of public safety, and from advocates who continue to hammer at the city's codes that restrict where unsheltered people can sleep, smoke, take their dogs, gather, and ask for money. In the budget for 2018, council directed the manager to set aside $1 million to fund a public shelter with a deadline of this spring for a plan for how that shelter will be established, managed, and funded. To prepare that plan, the city and county contracted with the Technical Assistance Collaborative, TAC, to assess our current system and recommend how a shelter could integrate and augment services to help people regain stable housing. The TAC's report with 10 recommendations was delivered to the City Council and the County Board of Commissioners in early January, and a steering committee is now meeting to prepare the next steps for implementing those recommendations. Councilor Siret and I sit on that steering committee. There are two things I want to emphasize about this work. First, we are now better positioned to improve the access to services that are already in place in our community. The initial projection shows us that with full utilization of existing services would allow us to serve an additional 898 individuals. So these are services that are not full. People are not using all of the beds. They're not applying for all of those programs. If we add to those services a 75-bed shelter and 350 permanent supportive housing units, more than 1,900 additional people could be served. This would fill the gap identified in the annual point-in-time count of 1,642 people who are unsheltered, in emergency shelters, or in transitional housing. We have made a strong start in addressing veteran homelessness through Operation 365, which has housed 860 veterans in 4 years. We can do this. Second, addressing homelessness is inextricably linked to our housing supply. The key message of the recent analysis is that people who receive services need to be able to move on to more permanent housing, thereby opening shelter and transitional beds for others. Our system is bottlenecked by a limited supply of housing at the most affordable levels, whether it is permanent supportive housing for people who need services or workforce housing for lower wage households. The recent report recommends that we add 350 permanent supportive homes as one piece of the larger puzzle aimed at restoring an adequate stock of housing to meet a range of needs. As with homelessness, the housing shortage is not solely of our own making. The recession, coupled with reduced federal support for affordable housing, slowed construction, while our rebounding economy and attractive amenities have brought a surge of new residents, all needing a place to live. Most of our residential land is zoned for single-family houses. And while more compact housing types like duplexes, triplexes, quads, and quads are permissible, our codes over recent decades have made them harder to build. We have a neighborhood scheme that is designed to fit one niche. It is baked in, as one housing advocate has said. Whether we're talking about loosening restrictions on accessory dwelling units or easing lot size or locations for duplexes, we are talking about a shift in a landscape that many had hoped or expected would be permanently fixed as it is. Housing is fundamentally an equity issue. Fixed and unchangeable neighborhoods harden economic and societal and social barriers. We know, for example, that children growing up in poverty will get a better education and have more opportunities if they are able to attend a school with a diverse student population and not ghettoized into the poorest schools serving only the poorest families. The way to bake in that diversity is to enable people of all ages, races, cultural origins, and socioeconomic levels to live together in mixed neighborhoods. And that requires mixed housing types. For lots of reasons, we need denser housing options along major public transportation routes. On the other hand, Council is well aware of the controversy in neighborhoods where development threatens to overtax existing infrastructure and undermine neighborhood cohesion. One example of where public engagement can produce constructive compromise is currently underway in the River Road Santa Clara neighborhood. I am heartened by the Council's action this week on the construction excise tax. The ordinance was crafted after exhaustive conversations, championed by Better Housing Together, and supported by economic research as part of the city's Housing Tools and Strategies work. Negotiation and compromise are tough, but our goal is to create a funding stream that can help our development community, especially our smaller local firms, build the lower-end market housing that we need. That brings me to our third key issue, community safety. We are growing in all ways, and that is reflected in the emergence of big city problems. More people committing more violent crimes, and also more people who are homeless and living in our shared landscape. The community safety net determines how we respond to the homeless, to the pressures of population growth, to our willingness to invest in our community. Our neighborhoods, downtown, parks, and streets need to be and to feel safe. Two major steps were taken in 2018. First, Chris Skinner was hired as our new police chief. Chief Skinner brought new energy to the department and a fresh set of eyes and perspective for how to best meet the increasing challenges we face. The chief started off quickly. He made a commitment to fill the 18 empty positions in the EPD, the Eugene Police Department. Today, we have a fully staffed police force for the first time in many years. Second, in December, Council approved an $8.6 million 18-month boost in funding to increase our capacity in a range of community safety programs, including more police officers and 911 services, but also for outreach to youth, the Homeless Day Center, and for continuing investment in our community court. Those funds are already at work. The Street Crimes Unit rolled out in March and is focusing on houses that host criminal behavior and neighborhoods that are disproportionately impacted by property and personal crimes. In 18 months, through the cycle of this one-time investment, our community will look and feel safer, with increased and faster police responsiveness to calls and a police force that has more time for problem solving and getting ahead of situations that impact the perception and the reality of public safety. But in the long term, the community will have to make a commitment to provide sustainable funding if we expect to continue this momentum. A revenue team of three counselors and five community members has proposed a payroll tax for employers and employees that would be broad and shallow. Everyone would pay into it, and no one would pay a lot. We're taking the time to make sure the community understands this proposal and has a chance to offer insights or changes or other alternatives before we act. But there is no sidestepping the reality that a public safety system that meets our growing needs will require taxpayer support in one form or another. I often say that because of our inadequate general funds, the public now serves as our budget committee. We ask you to make line item decisions that in previous decades would have been fulfilled with general fund dollars. We call on you to agree to fund bonds and levies, pay a gas tax, and perhaps a payroll tax. This continuing appeal for money is frustrating for everyone. We'd rather not have to ask. The good news is that as we grow in population, we also grow economically. While that creates the pressures we experience today in the housing market, tomorrow we expect the development downtown and in the riverfront, our increasing attraction as a tourist destination, and the enormous investments at the University of Oregon in both athletics and science will come back to us in tax revenue. It's a balancing act, but the goal is always to build a tax base that can support the services we want and need. We can't do one without the other. We have to create a community that is attractive for people to live, so people will also invest in roads, parks, libraries, and yes, in public safety, housing, and solutions to homelessness. 2018 was a year of preparation. 2019 is a year of action, not just in council decisions, but for you as the public. With your continued feedback and support, we will succeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Venice. Now we'll take a few minutes for you guys to form your questions. So have at it.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the City Club of Eugene, our April 12th, 2019 program, Lunch with Mayor Lucy Venice. We'll now take questions from the City Club members who are present today. And I'd like to just please ask you to identify yourself at the microphone, and if you could limit your questions to 1 minute, that would be very helpful. So we'd like to go ahead and start process now.
Kathy Ging, likely the most important question you will ever answer as mayor, wireless transmission facilities, WTFs, proposed in front of every third to seventh home in 100-plus already erected in Eugene. A longtime Enviro activist stated that her granddaughter no longer allowed to visit her since the small cell 4, 5G antenna placed 40 feet from her room. After hearing from Friends of Amazon Creek and Families for Safe Technology, six PhDs and doctors and 50 taxpayers recently, what will you do to protect us from very high frequency millimeter waves, military grade, small cell towers already located 400, 800, and 1,200 feet from three South Eugene schools? Will you follow the lead of many California and other communities that are considering moratoria? Depreciating home values of 20 to 25% have been predicted. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, we did have a robust public forum on this question of the 5G small cell antennae. So, there are two different kinds of answers here. One is on the health question, and I will say that I personally, and I think this is true for many in council, share the concern that not enough health studies have been done on 5G and what their implications. Most of the work that has been done is related to people's management of their cell phones or 4G, because 5G hasn't really rolled out yet, so a lot of those studies are still new. So I'm very concerned about the lack of health studies on this. The FCC, of course, is the regulatory body. It is under their purview to determine whether a new technology complies with their health requirements, and they have said they don't need to do significant health studies on 5G, and so they have allowed it to be installed. So the city, in that respect, at this point, doesn't have authority over reducing that. The second piece is the kind of regulatory and legal options that we have. Again, installation, the implementation, the licensing of new technology falls to the Federal Communications FCC. It's not a city-owned thing. We are constrained in that any technology that the FCC rules in compliance with its own rules, the city has to allow that to be installed, and we cannot place barriers in the way. So the example I gave at City Council on Monday night was, and directly to Kathy's question, you know, if we wanted to change our, say, in our ordinance around the placement of facilities you can only place a small cell antenna every 1,500 feet, we would not be in compliance with federal law, because what the FCC and what the telecommunications company are telling us is, in order for these small cell antennae to work, they have to be 500 feet apart. So we're not allowed to put an ordinance that really makes it impossible for those facilities to be installed if the FCC has deemed them compliant and acceptable. So the city has taken, there's another piece to this, and the essential piece is the preemption of local authority here. And so this conversation specifically about FCC is part of actually a larger conversation around the FCC ruling to preempt local control over our rights away, and also ruling to reduce our capacity to charge fees for the use of our rights away. So this, for the city of Eugene, this is a very significant dollar amount, totaling $7 million a year in our budget that we gain through right-of-way fees that the FCC has ruled we can't charge in that way. So there are multiple layers here. The city is part of a suit. We've joined with other cities. We're signed onto a suit that is now to repeal those FCC rulings. That's now at the Ninth Circuit Court in California, so we're watching that court case roll through. We've also worked with our representative, Peter DeFazio. He has co-sponsored a bill in the National Legislature and Congress, House Bill 530, which again also would repeal some of these FCC regulations. The city's perspective is that our capacity to act on this is in moving that federal dial, that there's very little we can do constitutionally, legally, locally. So the final question around a moratorium is, and even the correspondence that I have seen from California is that as soon as, I think it was Petaluma, one of the cities, said they were going to restrict the distance to 1,500 square feet, they immediately received a legal challenge, a legal letter, at least saying you're in violation of federal law. So I would say as mayor, and I think I'm on pretty safe ground saying on behalf of the city council, that we would not embark on a pathway of a moratorium that would open the city to a legal challenge that we don't have legal standing to win. So again, this is a federal law. It's part of a larger federal context we're working in. But I am pushing for more health information. We are pushing for more health more health research to be done at the federal level, and we are trying to regain our control over our local rights of way.
Thank you for being here, Madam Mayor. I'm Jerry Smith, City Club member. I am totally dissatisfied with the lack of real data on homelessness. I think the report you got from some outsiders was a disgrace. It was just sad. The real problem with homelessness is lack of income. Americans with no money in their pocket, zero income. There's no data on that that's publicly available. You might be able to get the SNAP program to tell you how many people have zero income. The last I knew, it was tens of thousands of people who had zero income, not just 1,900 folks. The problem, I understand, again, is federal and state. We tried to improve welfare by making it universal through Social Security in the program we call SSI. What's happened is Scrooge is running that program now, and you have to wait literally years to have your application denied, because they have a policy of denying real applications two or three times before they accept them. And what that does is put lots of people on the street, mostly people with disabilities, and there's no federal money, and the state has had a welfare program. It's starting to kick it up a little bit for certain disabled individuals, but the TANF program has failed with children. We've had thousands of homeless children, not just thousands of homeless, but thousands of homeless children in our schools. I want the city to just be impossible at the state and the federal government. Just go after them. Say, you can't do this to us.
Jerry, do you have a question?
The question is, why isn't that happening? Why are we allowing Americans, mostly disabled Americans, to be out in the rain right now? There's certainly, if you really know of a single unfilled bed, I can tell you 20 people who could fill it in 15 minutes. There are people who are being told they're waiting 2 years on housing lists.
Yes. So I have a couple of responses. The first thing is, of course, the TAC report didn't talk about income specifically because we didn't ask them to do that. We asked them to look at our existing homeless services with an eye towards how a public shelter could fit and augment with those services. So we didn't ask them to do that work. The second thing is, I think that you're totally right. I mean, we have too many people who need jobs and we don't have jobs for them. We have this disconnect between the jobs we have and the workforce we have, and they're not well matched up, and people have lost opportunities. I have had multiple conversations both with the Lane Workforce Partnership and with Marge Hamilton, the president of LCC, and also with Val Hoyle, who's our new Secretary of Labor, around, you know, what are the ways in which we can help improve that connection to training and jobs. And I would say we have good people in place to do that work. Those three people have their eyes on this target of certainly helping people who need retraining. LCC has a long history of doing that. They're facing their own budget crises, but I think they're a key part of our answer locally in terms of that kind of retraining. And I think that the work we do in the high schools, and particularly, you know, the career and technical education in high schools that suits a sector of the student population that's not going to be college bound, and we're short on, you know, people who can work in construction jobs, for instance. We need to train those folks. So I think there's a lot of conversation with the LCC and with the school districts around making sure that what the school districts are offering in terms of CET aligns with what the community college is doing, and that aligns with respect to what those different trades actually need, so that students coming through are well aligned to actually get their certifications as they go along. So I completely hear you, and I will just say one other sort of what I consider one of our really positive investments regionally is the Lane sector strategies work that, you know, initially identified the technology industry as a sector strategy in which we wanted to invest and ensure that it was robust. But the second sector is the food and beverage industry. And that food and beverage industry continued to grow and expand through the recession. And it is an incredible asset for us as a community because those jobs are the whole range of jobs. And people can come in at a lower level of training and learn on the job and work their way through. So we have the promise of many more jobs, and I think we have a lot of the right people in place to do that leadership, and I do have those conversations with them. So I hear you, and I agree.
John DeLoe, City Club member, and I have a nitpicking question here concerning impromptu but known homeless camps. Every now and then I see on the news they've come in and they've cleaned it up and they've spent thousands of dollars cleaning up. Why doesn't the city just bring in a dumpster and a porta potty and save thousands of dollars in their cleanup efforts? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. And on the face of it, your suggestion does make sense. And I have talked about this in the past about particularly with respect to folks that are camping on the river, that it would just be safer and cleaner for the people camping, for the rest of us, and for our water quality if we actually did just that, had porta potties and dumpsters and just you know, made it a little bit better. I think the problem we face really is a community safety problem. And it's a challenge of not wanting to have a lot of unsanctioned camping throughout the city where we can't monitor what's happening. So, you know, it's a mix because the folks that are out there are some of them just deep in poverty, unemployed for a long time, struggling in an economy that is unyielding and a housing market that is unyielding and a set of homeless services that are inadequate. So there's a whole group of folks out there that need and want services, and that's the focus of that TAC study. That's what we're aiming for, is to have a more a streamlined access to services so people aren't falling between the gaps and they're able to access services and then move on through the system. That is our goal, to address those folks. The other piece of this is just a community safety piece around where and how and who is camping and how we you know, protect both the people who are camping and the rest of the public. And people are not all of the same mind about this, right? I mean, some people want us to let people lift a ban, let people camp wherever you want, and there are other people want us to clean it all up and give them bus passes to go somewhere else. And the city is, you know, navigating this pathway down the middle. And I do think that the combined initiatives of the City Council and of the City of Eugene, first on the TAC report to improve our services to homeless, and now on the community safety that embraces a whole range of services to try and get people to target our endeavor and try and get people into services to increase both police responsive time, but also increase our services to people at risk who are out in our public spaces. These two endeavors are critical and they will work together. And I do believe that as we implement both of them, you as the public will see a big difference. You will see the value of that work and the positive outcomes of your tax dollars. So yes, we have a long way to go, but we are on the right trajectory and I have high hopes for how this is gonna look 2 years from now.
Mary Layton, City Club member. So I have a question about infill development. I live and walk almost every day near Rest Haven Cemetery, and I know the owner wants nothing more than to develop the south half of his property into housing. I would like to see it into low-income housing. I would like to see another village, Woodleaf, like Woodleaf Village. Mm-hmm. What is the obstacle to that development? All of the problems people raise seem like problems that are solved every day in a hilly, rocky place like this with lots of water. What is keeping that from happening? Because Tim says, by the way, it's the city.
So, right.
And, right. So I'm curious, how could we make it happen?
Right. I can't answer specifically on that, but I can, you know, I will say in general, you're right. We put lots of barriers in the way of that infill development of all kinds, and that was the focus of the Housing Tools and Strategies work, was let's be very specific about what those barriers are, and let's be very strategic about how we lift them and remove them. And so the first round, the Housing Tools and Strategies work group met for 4 times, 3 hours each time, and this culminated in a list of 83 possible strategies to remove barriers. And they teased out of that initially a dozen, which were basically administrative things that our planning and permitting departments could really just do on their own without coming back to council. And some of those will make a difference because some of those have to do with how things are trenched or where they're put in, or, you know, there's some various pieces. The next chunk the council is now working on, and, you know, some of it has to do with how we apply system development charges and when people pay them. Some of it has to do with how we are accounting for tree cover and are there adjustments we would make in tree cover. Some of it has to do with buildable slopes and how we look at those slopes. So, yes, I would agree that the city has some significant barriers we've put in the way to those projects moving forward in a timely way. And what happens is it takes so long that builders just walk away. They say, I'll put 2 years into this and it's still not there and I'm walking away. So yes, you're right. We need to fix it. We're working on that fix. And some of those are actually pretty challenging zoning and code questions. So it's a bumpy road, but it is the road we're on.
Cliff Gray, I won't be as long-winded as I usually am. I have a short question. So for Lucy, please clarify how the CET, that's the construction excise tax, is working to increase funding without payback to the construction developers via the system development charges.
That's a perfect question this week, having just passed that, and it was quite a discussion. So the construction excise tax, as passed, rolls in a tax that would be applied to the value of building permits for all residential and commercial construction. And in the first year, it's 0.33%, and then it goes up to half a percent in the second year, and it will hold at that level of 0.5%. what Cliff is referring to is we also agreed in those first 2 years, in those transitional years, that the systems development charges for each of those projects would be reduced by the equivalent amount of the construction excise tax. So they wouldn't in the first 2 years be faced with a cumulative increase. They would just get one increase. By year three, all of those projects will pay the full amount. So it was a endeavor to phase this in a way that would be more acceptable. And I will say, quite a few people have objected to that, as I assume you do. But here, what we are doing is creating a legacy. We are creating a long-term sustainable funding source that we can then reinvest in more affordable housing. It will go to housing providers like Cornerstone, but it will also go to small local developers who want to build that lower end market housing but can't make it pencil out now. And those funds in the construction excise tax will be used to help leverage other state and federal funds. So it's not just the value they are in and of themselves, it's what they enable us to leverage. So yes, I know it catches in people's throats a little bit that there's this transition time, but one of the extraordinary things about this whole process on the construction excise tax was the extent to which there was community consensus, an agreement that we would come together for this better good. And even the building industry, not loving it, of course, not loving it, no one loves to get a new tax, but also recognizing that they'll be the beneficiaries of it, that they'll be able to build some stuff and that they wouldn't have built otherwise, and that they'll benefit from that. So I heard words of wisdom years ago about, don't judge something on the short range impact and lose sight of what the long range goal is. And this is one, remember what the long range goal is.
If I could add, the intent of the state legislation, does it not violate a portion of that by acting as a discouragement to building above market rate housing?
So you're saying by helping to support more affordable housing, we're discouraging the construction of
expensive?
No. I'm not following the question.
No, by reimbursing this CET to the construction people themselves for the above market rating.
Reimbursing them. They're reducing their system development charges by an equivalent amount for 2 years.
Well, it's kind of the same thing.
It's not reimbursing. It's they're going to pay. We're reimbursing the city is filling in the gap is what's happening.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mike Rose, City Club member. Our table is curious about the status of the City Hall and if you had a particular preference. And is the county courthouse getting in the way too?
Okay, perfect question, because this is one of those things when I actually was first running for office and I appeared before all of you, I said, right, this is one of those sort of black hole issues. It's like it's out there for so long that you just think it's been, sucked up in a black hole and it's never going to see the light of day again. But actually, there's a lot of work going on here. And so, as you know, we have finally succeeded in transferring these two properties. So the county now has the old City Hall lot. The city now has the Butterfly lot and the associated farmers market area. And so we're now referring to this project as the Town Square project because we're seeing it as a whole reconfiguration of our town center. So we're wanting to look at how we might redesign or revitalize those park blocks. We're looking at the permanent farmers market. We have money in our urban renewal fund that's been set aside. It's, kind of waiting for more plans to materialize on a permanent farmers market, and so that now we want to build that in concert with the designs for the new City Hall, so that block becomes really a civic center. So, there are a lot of issues along the way. It's coming back to council. I don't think it's coming back this. I think it's coming back to council in May or June. I can't quite remember at which point. So the work is proceeding. The council has made a request that they really want to sort of dial in the budget first. This is how much we have to spend, and that's how much we'll spend. So I think the manager will be coming to council sooner than later about how to fill in the gap, because money has changed. So we spent money on the purchasing, on sorry. We spent money demolishing the old city hall and creating that buildable lot that we have now sold to the county. So we've got some of that money back. We spent some money on design. So, you know, we have maybe half of the amount of money in hand that we really need to build the city hall. So there's some negotiations with the council and, you know, about where the rest of those funds are going to come. So that'll be the first, I think that those will be the first issues, and then we'll be looking as we go along on the design issues. But it's coming. I'm not going to be moving into it in my first term of office, that's for sure. But you know, the work is moving forward.
Sue Walling, City Club member. Our table was concerned about the people who kind of hang out on the sidewalks downtown, and several of them said either they or their friends just won't come downtown because they don't feel comfortable. So we had kind of a two-part question about that. In the first place, how much do we know about who the people hanging out on the streets are? Are they our local homeless people? Are they in fact homeless? Are they from elsewhere? You know, who are they exactly? And then secondly, if we were to take care of the homelessness problem, would it also take care of the people hanging out on the streets, or are they on the sidewalks, or are they separate issues?
That's a really good question. So the first question around do we know who they are, I would say that Sergeant Smith and that whole downtown team knows exactly who they are because they're talking to them every day. I think the Red Caps know who they are. We do know who they are. And you know, if you watch Sergeant Smith or any of those downtown police work, I mean, they're really incredible. They walk up to those people and say, you know, how are you doing today? Is there something I can do for you? Or, you know, it's a pretty constructive conversation. Certainly our goal in providing services, well, let me say three things. Our goal in providing services to people who are homeless or in need of homelessness is that they would not feel that they had no place to go and that the sitting on a cold sidewalk was the best place to be, right? That's really the goal. That's not the best place to be. So in the short term, the city, the part of that $8.6 million bridge funding does include a day shelter. And I keep thinking that this is going to be a headline any day now, but there's been this very long, the city is in long discussions about a specific facility. We will dial it in. It will come. We are invested. I think once we create a day shelter, day center, that is going to change the dynamic downtown quite a bit, because then the police will be free to say, you can't be here, but you can be there. And that is what Chief Skinner is really asking, is let's create a safe alternative so we have some place to suggest they go. You know, we want a vibrant downtown, and so I'm happy when there's a mix of folks down there, and we just want to make sure that the folks who are, you know, spending time on the sidewalk, that they're visiting with friends, that they're safe, that they're not dealing drugs, that's all good, right? I don't want to make it so antiseptic that there's only one kind of person that's allowed downtown, but we just want to make sure that people who need a place to be get a place to be, and that it feels welcoming to everyone.
I'm Bailey. I'm a city member through the NAACP, and my question was on the panhandling initiative. It just seems like another way to push the homeless out and not provide any services to help them in the long run. So I was just wondering, what are the consequences of this initiative and what programs are exactly in place to help them if this is passed?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So we're calling it the panhandling. That's the sort of short term. It's really a ordinance around vehicular donation or something. I can't think what it, contributions, but the rule would be, if it's approved, the rule would be parallel to Springfield's rule, which is you as a driver, when you're stopped at a stop sign or a stoplight and someone asks you for money, would be forbidden from handing them anything unless you pull out of traffic and park your car and then go and give them the donation. So you would always have that option to do that. The advocates have argued that this is a safety thing. I'm unpersuaded. When I worked at Shelter Care, this actually was one of my ways that I opened a speech, as I would start my speeches with saying, how do you feel when you stop at an intersection and someone is outside your window asking for money? What's your reaction and what do you do? And when I talked about that at Shelter Care, I talked about it in light of that's a moment for you to take a little self-assessment about, are you thinking about a long-term solution to homelessness, or are you thinking about an immediate need? And I don't have an answer for that for the average person. I think, You know, sometimes the person's plight really calls to you and you have a $5 bill right there and you just hand it to them. And so my perspective is that should be allowed. We shouldn't be penalizing the public because they have a compassionate moment, as long as it's relative, as long as it's safe, as long as it's not a traffic barrier. You know, my preference would be that we would all take all those dollar bills and $5 bills that we might be doing that with and make a more significant donation to community-supported shelters or shelter care or some, you know, some other agency that's providing long-term solutions. But sometimes somebody just needs, they need to get on a bus, or they need a hot cup of coffee, or what they, you know, whatever it is. And so that's my feeling about that, which is it's not my favorite way to use a public ordinance. It will be close in council. And so I think council is very divided on this issue, and I recognize that the citizens who have testified before us feel very strongly about this. They're very bothered by it. They feel it makes the city feel very unwelcome and, you know, kind of unpleasant. And I get all that because it's uncomfortable. And I think we probably all feel that uncomfortable. We feel our own privilege when we're sitting in a car safely and someone's outside. We all feel that discomfort. So the penalty is on the driver. The penalty is a $50 fine on the driver. So it's not a further penalty to the person who's asking for money.
I did have just a follow-up. So would that increase the work of our local police department, because they would be the ones enforcing this this new regulation as well?
Yes. This would be adding another possible task, because otherwise, if we pass an ordinance but we have no police equipped to enforce it, then what have we just done? So yes, it would be added to their list of duties.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Shorak-Petty, City Club member, and I would like to mention the E-Web building. I have to tell you, I'm disappointed that the City Council didn't consider that to me as the City Hall. It seems centrally located. It's in a beautiful location, lots of parking, plenty of space to house all the services. And the Butterfly Lot actually did belong to the Skinner family. And I don't know if there's enough buy-in from the city to build just a small, really expensive City Hall that won't house all the services. And then a farmer's market, I think, is a great idea, but I like going to an outdoor farmer's market. If it's indoors all the time, it's not. I love the outdoors. So I'm just, is there going to be a part that's outdoors? And I'm just wondering, what is the future of the E-Web building? Because I think we missed a great opportunity, but maybe you have another idea for it.
Yeah, I'll say a couple of things. I mean, that decision is made, so we're not going to reconsider the E-Web building as a City Hall, much to Councillor Clark's dismay. I think that the sense is that we want to invest in our town center, and the having the our city offices right in that historic town square has both a civic value, it has an economic value, it has a safety value. I mean, we as people who are working and elected officials, we're back and forth in the downtown core all day long. We're going to those coffee shops, we're meeting people for lunch. We're part of that bustle downtown, and it's part of that downtown strength. So that was part of the image. I don't know what the farmers market will look like in the end, but they do want a year-round farmer's market, so they will want some part of it that's covered. That doesn't necessarily assume it will be uncovered. So the city is in the process of negotiating with E-Web a purchase of the E-Web headquarters. So there was a strong feeling amount council that we wanted to have the option to use that for some civic purpose, or at least prevent it from being sold elsewhere. So we're in that negotiation. I think we'll hear more from the city manager in the coming month about where we are with that. And I think there are a number of civic groups that are interested in different uses for that building. We're open to it. We just want to make sure that property is kind of still within under our control until we determine the best use, or we find the best occupant for it. So that door's not closed.
Okay, but the city, I just thought of something, the Lane County Courthouse will then be sitting empty. Was that ever considered as a city hall replacement?
Well,
figured for the city hall?
Yes. So if you want to take the time and go back to all the deliberations in 2016, you will see all the scenarios that were played out around that and all of the considerations around the courthouse. So when the county built its new courthouse on the new city hall, the old courthouse will then be empty. And so then the city will have the option, we have the first right of refusal. We will have the option to buy the old courthouse. So we could buy it and decide we're going to renovate it and consolidate more city services there. We could decide we're going to buy it and knock it down and build a new building there. Or we could decide we don't want to buy it. So yes, but the timeline is pretty long because the county, right, they're on the May ballot now to fund their new courthouse or the legislature acting. It's going to be a number of years before they're ready, and so it'll be quite a few years before they actually move out of that building.
Hi, Mayor Venice. Thanks for being here. Doug Bovee, City Club, and saw you last night at the climate town hall, so I know you're involved in that as well. Follow-up question regarding the construction excise tax. So 0.5%, the legacy question, 0.5% I think is going to raise about $1.5 million a year. Many people wanted the full 1% from day one because it's more like $3 million. So there's going to be a lot of push to raise it to 1%. What will it take to do that?
Perfect question. The written into the ordinance is the stipulation that the construction excise tax, that both the dollars gained and the use of those dollars will be reviewed every 2 years. So when we're in year two, when we're ready for the full rollout at a 0.5%, but developers paying the full SDC charges, we will have our opportunity to do a full review. And so that will be data driven, and that will be another opportunity for the community to step out. And yes, so the council was very divided on that 1%, as was the community. I will say that, you know, the longest running biggest success story on a construction excise tax is Bend. Every other city has only had theirs for a year or so because they just did it when the legislature entitled. But Bend had already established an excise tax, and theirs has been successful. They stayed at a 0.33%. They never even bumped it up to 0.5% in Bend, but theirs has been so successful because the funds are directed by a housing committee, a housing authority. So we will be setting up a similar housing authority, and it is the effectiveness of that committee that determines the effectiveness of how the tax is used, because that committee then identifies how those funds can leverage other funds and distributes them effectively. So there are two pieces here. There's the dollar amount, but the dollar amount is really how you leverage the other dollars. And so in the most successful example, and the most long-running example, they held it a third of a percent. So I think the jury's out on whether we need to go up to a 1%, but we'll evaluate it every 2 years.
Thanks for coming. I'm Jim Dotson, a City Club member, and this is a question you probably get asked, and you may not have a whole lot to say about it, but there's a big empty building that LCC used to have, the old Monkey Ward building. I'm curious to know what your thoughts might be about that, and if you could offer any prognostications.
Yeah, we'd like it. We'd like it. I think so. The city is discussing with LCC the potential for the city to purchase that building. And there are lots and lots of different stakeholders who are interested in either using the building as it is or being able to tear it down and build on that. And I think from the city's perspective, it's part of our urban renewal district. We have set aside, right, designated that as one of our projects. And I mean, a lot of us have our particular wish list. So it is seen as a community asset where I think LCC is very eager to part with it, so the city and the LCC have to agree on the price, basically. And we haven't had, council has not yet had a public conversation about that, but I know the conversations between staff, between city manager and the president and board, I know those conversations are happening. So something will happen there. We're eager to see something happen there.
Look, we've got one more question.
Oh, good. Sandy Erickson, City Club member. I would like to know what kind of plans the city has made long-term for the prevention of homelessness, working with the school district. And I'm not talking about training people to go to work. I'm talking about educating people for better financial planning, better consumer education, better health and food and nutrition information so they aren't hit with huge medical bills and obesity. There's a whole field of topics that I know personally is not being addressed in the school system or by the city because I've researched it. And I can't understand why the city doesn't seem to believe in prevention.
Okay, I have a couple of answers to that. And the first is that when we talk about permanent supportive housing, that supportive word refers to exactly that kind of service. It refers to exactly that kind of nutrition, education, cooking, financial management. That's exactly what that refers to. So it is part of our picture of what we do. And that we have, I mean, I used to work for one, shelter care. We have nonprofit providers who provide those supportive services in the community. That's not a city function that we do that. That's a nonprofit function, and it's funded through Lane County, through the Human Services Commission. So there is expertise in that area, and it is a key part of how we stabilize people permanently. We also do look at, and I think this is the trend, we had a lot of success with this when Obama first took office and funded the stimulus funding. A lot of that was used, prioritized for homelessness prevention. And homelessness prevention also includes, you know, working with people before they lose their housing to help them retain their housing. And so some of that can be financial management, nutrition, grocery shopping. It can be that whole package of opportunities to really improve life skills. So I would say, I actually disagree with you that we're ignoring that. I think we have providers who do that work. I think the city provides funding to the Human Services Commission in order to make that work happen. And I think it's not enough. I mean, one of the pieces that we know and is very clear in the tax study and that we know just by living in this community is those services are not well enough funded and they're not robust enough. And you know, I talk very optimistically about 350 new units of supportive housing. That's a heavy lift to get that many units of housing.
John Belcher, time? Okay, very quick. As you know, in the current legislature, there are two bills that would have a significant impact on the city. One is Senate Bill 10, which would mandate that along our major corridors, we would have to densify essentially to what's around the university area within a quarter mile and at least multifamily housing within a half a mile. So that would be a mile-long stretch which would cover more than half of our city, making us multifamily. Number two is to Senate Bill 2001, which would require every single family lot to have the potential of adding a duplex, a triplex, a fourplex, or a cluster subdivision. If those were to pass, how will Eugene respond, given that we've had so much trouble allowing accessory dwelling units?
The big challenge for both of those bills, the first big challenge for City Council and for the city, is the local preemption, that it would preempt our local zoning rules and all of the planning work we have done. But the second big challenge for both of those is the planning time that would consume in order to figure out how to comply. And so there would be a snowball effect in terms of all of the other planning processes that we currently have in motion would get put on hold because we would be under a timeline to comply with those bills. So we're opposed to it for some very significant reasons, and we'll see what happens in the legislature.
Thank you very much. Give it up. We'll have another opportunity to thank today's speaker, but before that, there are a few quick announcements. I'd like to thank KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 6:30 p.m., and thank to you, Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club events. Next week, we will host Oregon's Congressional delegation and Congressman Peter DeFazio. Please join us and find out what is taking place in Washington, D.C. Transportation and infrastructure will be the focus. Please join us on, I might have to have the wrong event on that. But please join us next week for this important City Club event. For more details and information about future programs, you can find that information online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's thank our guest speaker, Mayor Lucy Vinnis. And thank you all, City Club members and guests. This concludes today's program.